Hello everyone, I'm Liz Vargas, and you're listening to episode 41 of the Art Scene Podcast. Since this weekend is the 4th annual San Francisco Art Book Fair, I thought it'd be great to have one of the exhibitors in this year's fair on the podcast. So today's guest is Adrian Martinez, who is a Bay Area photographer, a member of the San Francisco Photography Club, and co-founder of the art collective Illitant. Here's our conversation, where I get to talk to Adrian about his unique upbringing in Los Angeles, his immersion into the Bay Area art scene, and what he plans on showing at his table over at the Art Book Fair this year. Yeah, man. So thanks. Love to have you on here. I know we've been talking about it for a while over it, and we work together. So yeah. Well, aside from that, we also talk shit about baseball, of course, because you're from the LA area.
Oh yeah.
And I'm from San Diego. And
oh yeah.
I'm, you know, growing up, a lot of people think San Diego and LA are the same. They are not.
Oh no, I refuse that. I feel for the Charger fans in my life. So, you know, I'm right there with you, dude. I love talking smack about sports. I grew up on a humble beginning with sports, and somehow it just kind of like took a mind of its own, and I've become like pseudo sports obsessed. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and now with baseball season going, I just check in with you.
Yeah, man. I mean, let's see what's up with your Padres. You know where my mind's at.
Oh,
I'm bleeding blue in a city of orange.
That's the real story of San Diego. We have the beautiful beaches, but we suffer as sports fans.
Hey, man. Yeah, I'd trade it. I trade it for LA's, you know, crummy lifestyle. That's why I live here.
So were you like born and raised in LA?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I was born in South Pasadena, but more or less in the Mount Washington area. A lot of my family lives there. I guess like going into background a little bit, my dad's from Cuba. He's a lot older. He moved he left Cuba in 1960, right after the revolution.
Wow.
With Castro taking power.
Yeah.
Lived in Europe for 10 years, you know, kind of, you're going to get an abridged version with all the different weird shit that he did and got back. But once our family trickled out, that Cuban side ended up in Glendale in LA.
Wow.
And, yeah. So,
which is weird because normally like you hear like Miami.
Yeah,
or, like,
of course, South Florida. It was very peculiar. Just like a small contingency of really close friends in this city where my dad lived in Cuba managed to end up in LA.
Wow.
And a lot of them are still there and have gone on to be really successful in LA.
Wow.
So anyway, he ended up in LA 10 years after being in Europe. And that's where my family established themselves. My mom, who's Mexican, immigrated through the Braceros program. My grandfather was a miner. He was a day laborer in the mines.
Wow.
And he actually found a way to legally get almost all 11 of his kids and his wife here legally through that program with green cards.
That's nuts.
So my one uncle had to marry his older brother's girlfriend.
Yeah. What a different time, that Brazil program, huh?
Yeah, it was a different time, man. That was 1966 when my mom got here. She was 11.
Wow.
So then, you know, fast forward through some weird mining towns, my family ended up in East LA, like a typical Mexican immigrant family.
Yeah.
My mom went to high school there. She went to Occidental College. Flash forward many years, got a job teaching and met my dad.
Wow.
And so a lot of my family spread out around the LA area, Highland Park, East LA, Pasadena.
Yeah.
And that's where I was born. So that's, I was born there and my parents split up pretty promptly. You know, a true 90s kid, I guess.
Are you an only child?
I'm not. I got siblings. My dad is on his third marriage. He had my oldest half sister with number one. That was a woman he met in France where he was living. Then he married my mom and had my sister and I. She's a little older. She lives in the city now as of 2 years ago, which is rad. And then my mom remarried after my dad and had my little brother, who's, you know, half, but we grew up together. And he lives around the corner, actually, right now. He just moved.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was born in Highland Park area. I spent my adolescence because of the split between there and the West Valley. And I really didn't like L.A. growing up. A Dodger fan and loving Latino culture.
Well, what about it that you didn't like?
The weather. I also had like the most chronic allergies out of everyone in my family. Like
isn't
it was
that,
crazy.
Isn't that weird though? It's because so isn't weird. The history of like California that people left because they had chronic allergies in the East Coast? They came to LA.
They came here. And, you know, most of my family didn't have them, but like I was in fourth grade with like the same, literally the same model breathing machine, like a powered
inhaler
as my 85-year-old grandmother. So I had I don't know. I had all these problems.
That's crazy.
I was a chubby kid because I wouldn't get out because of the pollens, and like I was allergic to grass. I played video games. I stayed in a lot. The heat was oppressive in the West Valley. There were just a lot of things. And you know, I felt like a lot of my creative interests were constantly tinged with this hue of coolness, like LA glamour. And like, I didn't really fit into that. So, and you know, I didn't really have a ton of money. Like, I was grateful that my parents were both working professionals, owned their own businesses, so raised me well enough. But they, you know, I wasn't flashing money around. I wasn't driving an import car. You know, I had a Nissan in high school. It was chill.
Well, what kind of businesses do they have?
They're actually both interpreters. So they met as teachers. No way. Maybe I mentioned that earlier. They met as teachers, and they both actually quit around the same time when they realized, well, teaching was really tough. The pay was not very good. And my mom stumbled into a summer gig between school years one time, and someone was like, hey, you take this quick test with the court, you get certified as a court interpreter.
Wow.
And it was like, you can just do freelance work and, like, you know, you can get $300 for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And mom was like, that sounds dope.
Right. Work for myself.
Yeah. And then she was like, quickly, she was like, this isn't a summer gig. I think I'm just going to do this full time. Like, I could get all my siblings to pass this test and we could start our own agency. Like,
that's crazy.
What if we did that? Man, and sure enough, she did that. Even pulled my dad from teaching after the fact. He joined her agency. You know, fast forward many family dramas later, my mom has a competing agency with my dad and her siblings. So
that's crazy.
A whole other thing. But that's, they both made their money in interpreting. My dad met his now wife. She's another interpreter. They run their agency together. My mom met my stepdad. So they were interpreters in workers' comp, typically. So, you know, workers' comp.
Oh, yeah.
Getting injured in
the
job.
They totally need that, man.
You know, a lot of immigrants work in labor jobs. So they need interpreters to talk to the doctor, the insurance agency, the attorneys. At the time, my stepdad was a workers' comp attorney.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's just kind of like all through interpreting, my whole family in LA, like, they have kind of this weird, funny legacy.
Yeah.
Like, everyone knows my family in that scene. So it's just kind of like, it's a trip.
So you didn't want to follow the family business?
No, not at all. I actually thought I wanted, I got really into sports later in high school along with my creative stuff. And I thought I wanted to be like a PT, like a physical therapist. And I was like, this is really cool. Like, I was skating a lot and I was like, this would be cool. Like, I could be a doctor and then my parents will be stoked because I'm a doctor. And that's also like, I'll get some good money and like, you know, I'll get to work around sports. Like, that sounds hella cool. And, you know, I went to school, like, looked for programs like that, ended up in USF. Oh, by the way, I didn't get to finish my hate on my hometown thing, but I didn't like LA a lot. And I started going to this summer camp, a skateboard camp up outside Fresno in Sequoia National Forest.
Right.
And I went there for like 13 years of my life. Most of the kids that worked there were from the Bay Area. So I started becoming like really interested. And then my sister, she went to school in Seattle. So I was like, oh, Seattle, Bay Area, like one of these two cities has got what I want.
Yeah.
So, you know, really early on, like 14 years old, I was like, dang, San Francisco is a cool place.
I got to tell you, you're like maybe the third person I've interviewed that has a similar relationship to the Bay Area, where they're from somewhere different.
Yeah.
Whether it's like New York, Florida, like, I mean, even the Midwest, and people have this, like, the connection is like
cultural.
Yeah. Like, they met somebody or knew people, or the idea of like the Bay Area seemed more their scene than what they were with.
Yeah, man.
And, you know, in a lot of it's skater centric, street art centric.
Skate community is really close. Street art was like harder to break into, but like the skate community was so embracing. Like, I just remember like art, graffiti, skateboarding was way more like violent and aggressive and like testosterone driven in LA and Southern California.
Yeah.
And here it felt like every community was way more opening. So I feel like, you know, just right away I came up here. I had one cousin who went to Cal in 93 and like she stayed in Oakland forever. So I took a road trip early in high school and like visited the city, stayed with her. Like, everyone was right away like, you skate? Like, they weren't like, blow you off. They were like, oh, what do you like to do? Like, what are you doing later? We're all hanging out. We're going to watch a video at my friend's apartment. And I was just like, damn, this is really inclusive and just, you know, really friendly. And no one knows, you know, the big joke, no one knows I suck at skateboarding. Like, but I love it. And I've always been the photo guy. So, or just, you know, the guy who's around. So anyway, yeah, that was one of the reasons. And, you know, going back to that other tangent, I thought I was going to be a PT. I looked at some schools. My big decision was Vermont, where I had some scholarship money, or USF. Probably had to take some more loans. And I was playing soccer at the time. So I had a way to get on both teams.
Oh, like to play collegiately?
Yeah, to play collegiately. And yeah, just I visited Vermont. They said it was the nicest weekend of the summer. Spoiler alert, you know, below 40 at night, but 70 and sunny during the day with a slight breeze. And
I was like, sounds awful.
Yeah. I mean, the soccer stadium was covered. I always tell this joke. People will laugh if they hear that, but it was covered. And I was like, why is it covered? They're like, the season's during the winter.
Well, like, I got to ask, like, when, you know, you're talking about this idea of wanting to be a PT and stuff.
Yeah.
But you said creatively you were doing stuff in high school. What were you getting into creatively?
Music was always a strong interest. You know, my dad actually was very into the visual arts and was very, like, keen on sharing that with us early on.
In what way? Like going to museums?
We spent a lot of time in museums. My dad collected art. This community and, well, you know, the main area he lived when he left Cuba was in France by virtue of that being the one country where there was asylum.
Sure.
And a strong Cuban community that was educated and free education.
Wow.
So, you know, he went for the trifecta, and, you know, a lot of Cuban expats that went to Paris, a lot of them were like semi-successful artists at the time in the 50s and, you know, in Cuba.
Yeah.
So, you know, quite a few, you know, gay people and like alternative lifestyle.
Right.
And, you know, my dad, when he was in Paris, he connected with a lot of these people through the Cuban embassy, which at the time was just like, you know, a refugee center.
Right.
And he just started hanging around art circles. I don't think he ever, you know, I always have to ask, I guess I'll have to ask him, but I don't think he ever really got into that for any other reason than it was just his community.
Right.
And, but as
like,
long as
it's my friend's stuff, I might as well support him and buy a piece.
But like,
right. Yeah.
Homeboy was there and smart enough to get like an original lithograph by Dali.
Wow.
When he was, you know, working as a pizza guy, he like saved up his money. And, you know, it's our equivalent of getting a screen print by an upcoming friend and maybe paying $200 when that's 1/4 of your paycheck.
Right.
You know, like it's that equivalent now.
Yeah.
But it's something he kept. And he has the stories of a Picasso drawing on a paper bag he couldn't afford that he, you know, looks back and gets pissed off at himself about. But, you know, there's these things that he had. And naturally, the Cuban art. So my dad collected a ton of Cuban art made by these friends of his at the time. And he was just always supporting them through life and just really has a close bond for no other reason than I think that's just his story.
Right.
So naturally he was interested, never really like got out there and like joined a museum or like a donor. Like he was particular and he was like reserved, but he was active.
Right.
So he would be like, let's go see this museum show, like Modigliani at LACMA. I remember that show very well. Like, let's go see this type of thing. Let's go to the Norton Simon and take a walk. Like, he was also doing his divorced dad thing, trying to like do activities with us, maximize time.
But it's interesting that he took you to museums.
I know.
Because when you hear stories like that, it's like a baseball game.
Right?
Right.
And
yeah,
we
yeah.
did that too.
Yeah.
We went, my dad lives 10 minutes from Dodger Stadium, I'll have you know, and we've been to many games. So the self-professed, not non-Dodgers fan, just baseball fan. He is a Dodgers fan, for the record. He made me who I am with Dodgers. So, you know, we had our Cuban time there.
Right.
And lots of cups of coffee. So, and lots of sugary desserts. Like, you know, the true Cuban way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, I think that there was just all these things about art going on. And at the time, I didn't really get it.
Yeah.
So I was thinking practically. I was always like, in some good classes, what am I going to do? And, yeah, I thought PT. And then I got to school and started taking my first college level science classes. And I realized, this is not me, man.
Yeah. Like, which is a typical story.
You learn right away.
Oh, for sure. And I went to a school that's similar to you. I went to USD.
Of course.
Which is
another
like,
Jesuit.
Is, yeah.
A little sister school down there.
Yeah. It's like a Catholic school just like USF on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I going there, everybody wanted to be a doctor. That was running joke.
Everybody.
And everyone took their first biochem class and they're like, oh, no, thank you.
Yeah. It was like the middle, you know, I was Latino, which was an interesting, like I always say a flavor on LA middle class, but I was middle class and it was, you know, I always joke, it was too brown for my AP honors friends and too white for my soccer team. So it was just like, it was just funny. And that was just by virtue of, you know, of education and opportunity. And I was always cognizant of it growing up. So I never,
like
never
at
was
USF.
An issue.
Yeah.
No, in high school.
Just in high school.
And then when I got to USF, I was just like, okay, like I'm definitely like, you know, I'm brown here for sure, which is fine. Like
isn't
there,
isn't
it was,
funny?
Yeah, know, it's, yeah. That's how it works. It's a private school. My first private school.
Yes.
I went
here,
to public
yeah.
school my whole life.
Yeah, same way. I'm the same way.
So it was a trip, but it was cool. And I mean, I was ready for it. And I honestly think as a result of going to such big public schools and having that duality, I knew how to get what I wanted out of college.
Yeah.
Maybe I could have gotten a few more A's, but I also had a great time. And made great relationships, and
right.
That was a springboard. I knew I figured out, like you said, my first bio class. No,
you're like, I'm out. Fuck so that. What did you gravitate to next?
I had a random fulfillment like graduation requirement in political science.
Okay.
And at the time, I was kind of getting interested with what was going on in the art community. I was like, well, a lawyer is kind of like another healthy job to have, like, you know, practical. Yeah. And I was like, what if I was doing? And I love music, and I was like, dude, nowadays, like, what do you have to do to get an ad with a song? Like, for a skate video, I was skating. I was like, you have to pay a band to have their song in their right. skate video. And I was like, there's a legal agreement. Like, you have to pay to have Barry McGee on the Adidas shoes
sure.
that Huff designed or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, who's doing that? Like, that sounds interesting. And I was like, politics are cool because at the school, it was like more history driven.
Sure.
Political, rather than political science and like all this theory, it was like a mix between history and political science.
Yeah.
And I stacked on a few double minors. Thought about business and a couple other things, and I ran with it. And you know, flash forward, my first job out of school, spoiler alert, office manager at a law firm. Had my second realization, I don't want to be a lawyer.
Did you take any art classes when you were in school?
No, man, I actually didn't. It was a trip. I didn't take any. I was into photographing. So yeah
I was gonna ask, when was the photography kick in?
So photography kicked in early on. I've always really been fascinated by like three things for sure. Like soccer, being a Mexican kid in a big family, and like that looming over was always like a fascination. Sure. There was guitars around my family, like singing, you know, rancheras and having like barbecues and hanging out. Like that was the end of the drunken night.
Right.
You know, so guitars were around, and I was always fascinated by the guitar players in my family.
Sure.
It's just a vital part. Like anyone could step up to try to sing. Right. So then that was an object that fascinated me. But the other thing that just happened to be in my family was like, my family was really big on photos.
Sure.
So they loved taking photos. And so everyone had a camera in my family. My mom took a darkroom class in high school and loved cameras. My grandmother in Mexico was randomly a Kodak dealer out of her fruit stand.
That's crazy.
And and I found this out way later in life, but like she was the town photographer, which the only gig in these small Mexican towns was births and deaths and marriages.
Right.
So she shot those.
That's crazy.
And like, yeah, so, you know, it was kind of like in the background, and I was always, there were all these covetous items. It's like, I want your soccer ball. Like, I want to play Theo's guitar. Like, I want your camera, mom. Like, when you're old enough, you know, get a camera. And I still have it. It's in this room around here. My first like point and shoot film camera, nice. Like 96 or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. It was just always around. And so I was just like from right away with skateboarding, you know, you want to capture skateboarding. Like, as you know, I said, I wasn't the best skater, so right away I was like, I had a camera. And you know, this idea of making your own content at a time that predated the internet was just so based on like photos and videotapes and burning your own cassettes, and even with music, with mixtape, it was like this big culture of you know, basically establishing this content as yours. Whether you're like unfortunately stealing the music from somewhere else,
sure.
But like the content you're making, this media was such a big deal. So I was like, I was always fascinated by that. And naturally, you know, first jobs, first things I got was saved up money was a guitar. And the second thing was like a big boy camera.
Yeah.
And then eventually just shot that thing to pieces all through high school and college. And then at one point there was always one camera hidden under my stepdad's bed. It was his film SLR. And that one to me looked so cool. The strap was cool. The lenses, like, yeah. It was the one you couldn't touch.
What type was it?
I have it. It's a Minolta X700.
Yeah.
So after my freshman year in college, I was like, I know what I'm doing. This guy hasn't touched it. He said it's broken. I'm going to go take it to a shop and fix it and shoot it. Sure enough, like, it needed a battery or something and, yeah. Like, a tune-up. So I took that thing, and that was in 2009. And since then, I've developed a crazy affinity for film, and the stories of my mom in the dark room got me to learn how to do that on my own.
Yeah.
This was all after college, but shooting film started in college, and I just really loved it.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about in college how you are, you know, you talk about being a PT or a doctor or something. Then you're like, not for me. And then you go like political science and then even the thought of law. And what's even funny is, which for me, and then this is my bias as a San Diegan, it's so LA that you're, yeah. Like, oh, maybe I'll be a lawyer. You know, people need, you know, musicians and artists need,
yeah.
Representation.
Yeah, man. There's parts of me that are clearly LA.
But like, it's also interesting, like, why isn't it, you know, because you were this entire time you are developing this passion for photography. why is it, you know, we never like went that route in terms of studying?
Like, yeah, it's crazy. It didn't seem like an option at the time, which is so crazy because, like, looking back, obviously I did have opportunities that a lot of kids my age that I could relate to didn't have. So right. It was a trip. I was like, all right, well, that's not really practical. Like, you know, I'm like one of the kids in my big family, like 36 grandkids from my grandmother, sure. that I was like, you know, going to be on the short list for sure of graduating college or going to college, sure. or graduating high school, I should say. So, you know, for me, I was like, I kind of felt like there was this pressure to do that. Yeah. I never really bothered. It didn't bother me. And I never bothered to like really question it, which is funny because I questioned everything growing up.
Yeah.
But it just usually meant with me making up my mind and like kind of having this, I was not confident in many things, but for some reason, like if I understood something and I could come to a conclusion, I was very confident that I felt good with my conclusion.
Yeah.
So at the time, it just seemed so innate that that wasn't a possibility. And like, I don't know, that stuff is funny. It's just like, I laugh at it now. And I even think about like, oh, would I even want to be a photographer now? And I still have similar thoughts. And it's just.
It's funny. I can relate to that because when I went to college, same type of school, same type of thing, public school, went to a private school, all of a sudden you stand out and you're like, shit, I'm the only brown person around. But yeah, you do feel that pressure, especially when you're from a family where not everybody goes to college or it's not expected of them to go to college, right? And now you're in it. Like when you're in it, you gotta like, you have this feeling like you have to make the most of it.
Yeah, you're like Luke Skywalker in a Mexican version. You're like, you're the hope.
Right.
You're gonna bring us all back.
Right. And in the back of your mind that like, you know, you're like, oh man, it'd be really great to be like an art major, but oh man, my family, they're gonna think I fuck up this opportunity, you know?
Yeah, but it was trippy because like at the time, I never really wanted to be an art major. I never really considered myself very creative. I knew I had an affinity for these creative things.
Right.
But I didn't have, I just didn't have like a really firm connection with myself where I was like, oh, I can make them.
Right.
Like that took time. And honestly, like it got nurtured heavily from being here. Like the community, like
you know, people that I met. Like being in the Bay Area.
Yeah, in the Bay Area, here in the Bay Area, sorry. But like even then, like it incubated that feeling I never felt like I had.
Yeah.
And allowed me to think like, oh, well, I could do that. Maybe smaller scale, like. I want to do that. Why not? Like,
sure.
I remember it just kind of started with the first roll of film and then like shooting it and then, you know, shooting photos for people and then like, oh, I'm going to make a zine. Like, oh, I'm going to actually develop my own roll of film. Like, I want to learn little pieces like that and then kind of having this momentum that, you know, is still, I think, being shaken out right now.
So for the most part, you're like self-taught.
A lot of things.
Because you didn't really like.
It's a tricky thing. Like, I don't have.
Like because you didn't weird. Like ever take like
no.
coursework in no. visual arts or anything. You no. kind of just did it snap and shoot.
Yeah.
But like it you know, because when I was in college, I was the same way. I minored in photo.
Yeah.
But what was interesting was I was a history major, and I really wanted to like study photography only because I liked photography. But the concept that it was a visual art form.
Yeah.
It. Didn't exist for me. I just liked taking pictures.
It
had nothing to do with like I wanted to be in the art world at all. And I remember even majoring in history on purpose because the argument I could make was that I could always, if I got my straight A's in that, I could go to law school with that.
Yeah.
And then I'd become a professional.
Yeah.
And never, you know, I always wanted to work in a museum, but I didn't think it was realistic. So I always just kept thinking, I got my history degree to rely on to go to law school.
Exactly.
And then it was funny because about halfway through school when like an art teacher was like, you know, you're like an artist, right? It's like, no, I just take pictures.
Yeah.
No. You take pictures, but you're an artist.
Yeah.
And even the concept of that was like, I don't think so.
Yeah, you're skeptical.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, man, I feel you. I had a similar experience. Like I thought about school that way and I thought about my photos like, I knew what I liked as an aesthetically pleasing photo, but I didn't really like, I wasn't thinking about it as art. I was just like, oh, that's the one. That's the best shot. Like when you're shooting in skateboarding, like that's the shot that wins. That's the one that stands out. Like that's the money shot. And you're like, okay, great. But then like the afterthought of like, oh yeah, that's actually like a piece of art. Like if I had my best photos in a room and hung them up, that would actually resonate. That I never thought of that either.
Wow.
So it's like, it's just funny. Like, I think the editing process, at least that's the way I think about it now, and a lot of people consider it, like, especially with making books and doing things like that, I think it's just heavily in line with that type of thinking.
Sure.
And I think that was probably the first step I took to really thinking about my art.
So now you're done with school.
Yeah.
You got a political science degree.
Yeah, right? I went and worked at a law firm for 3 years.
And what was the idea with that, working at a law firm?
Well, I didn't want to jump right into law school. Again, I was a bit skeptical.
So you're still thinking,
I was still skeptical.
Law school maybe in my horizon.
Yeah, and yeah. I was like, and a law degree is practical. You could go to, you know, own a business with a law degree, whatever.
Sure,
and I was
all
like,
that stuff.
All that stuff. And I was like, but I'm still skeptical. Like, I'm not going to go into debt. I'm not going to go straight to law school. Like, I want some time to, like, work and experience that. And, like, maybe law's not for me.
And did you do that here?
Yep. I found a job, luckily, through a former soccer coach. His wife was running a law firm. She was an attorney herself who had yet to pass the bar in California.
Sure.
She was running a small firm in Oakland, and she needed some help. It started with, like, 12 hours a week, and then, you know, a little more, until I was full-time and, like, managing the office. And that was, like, 3 years, and it was a really wonderful time.
Sure.
We did really meaningful work. It was honestly, like, the best thing it could have been.
Yeah.
But I was just so frustrated with the justice system and, like, learning how to play the legal game and, like, you know, the competitive drive and the output that's demanded to try to, like, one up someone in a game that's not necessarily fair. To me, it was disheartening. Yeah. And it was just like, I don't know if I could take someone's livelihood, put it in my hands, and be this confident that I'm gonna, like, play this game of, like, one-upmanship. Sure. With, like, the rule book, and basically saying, well, I interpreted it this way, and you interpreted it this way, and, well, because you skipped that page, I'm gonna go ahead and say you lost, because I actually read everything.
That's interesting.
And that's how it translated to me. That was, like, my baseline.
Like, it's like, it really bothered you that it didn't seem fair.
Yeah, and I was like, you know, at least in a sporting match, you know, or anything like that, I was like, clearly there's a winner, you know, in some way, like, based on merit and ability, like, right. Someone really trying hard and getting the most out of their ability. And maybe that is the same for law. Like, I'm not, you know, dumping on law, but I'm just saying, like, to me, having that be my set of abilities that I'm measuring success to, like, just was not attractive.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, it's a good point. I mean, like, you think about sports. I mean, it's probably going to sound cliche.
Yeah.
But, like, and especially for people who are not big sports fans, sure. Right? The reality is, in a sport, it is for the most part fair.
Which is why you have all the controversies.
Correct.
On all of it.
Right. And you, both sides do kind of win.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you have the winner, obviously, of the game or match or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the losers kind of, to get to the point where they got to the championship, to you know, the fact that was a lot of hard work. That's what they get out of it is the experience of going through that.
Yeah.
And then the experience of learning from their mistakes to see how they can do it again the next time, which is, like,
that's
the story of life.
Because it's still, that's right. Why they're second and third.
Right. And it's, which is the story of life, really, right? Yeah. It's just like, you're not going to always get it the first time, but it doesn't mean you're not going to get it the second or third time.
Yeah. It's yeah. Absolutely true, man, and I really stuck to that type of ethos and that type of thinking. My parents were also big athletes, you know, by virtue of, like, most families, like my mom's. The only way that my grandma would let them out of the house was if they were on a sports team.
Sure.
So all of my aunts and uncles were forced.
Isn't that
athletes.
The story of almost every yeah. Latino, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So all my parents, you know, even the sports they were shitty at, they were four sport athletes.
Right. They have to do extracurriculars to get out of the house.
My mom was actually good enough, like, she played professional volleyball and went to college for volleyball.
That's crazy.
So she, and it's funny because, like, in my adolescence, she left most of the sporting desire and, like, never really played sports as an adult and still doesn't.
Wow.
But she was like, yeah, she played volleyball and tennis in college. Wow. Just like, yeah. But, you know, that type of thinking and that hardworking mentality, like, I'd say my parents did a really good job of, like, keeping us honest and grounded. And, you know, and I was pretty lucky for that because it was definitely not the case with all of my family members. You know, I love them to death, but we've got a bunch of characters, and I was pretty happy that my parents were mine. You know, they did their shit too.
So then once you got tired of doing the law office thing, what did you do next? What was next?
Oh man, that was funny. So that was,
and what year are we at this point?
This point where, we'll add some years to the mix. I lived in LA till 2008, moved up here, graduated school in 2012. So we're entering 2012-13 with this law firm. We're leaving this law firm in 2015. Halfway through the law firm. So this is kind of like where the arts and other stuff kind of kicks off. While I was at the law firm, a friend of mine was a director at 5024SF, Trevor Martin. I knew him through an internship in like skating back in the day in LA. He moved to the Bay Area and was working with Upper Playground. Are you familiar with that
brand? Yeah.
So yeah, they were like, you know, affiliated with Juxtapose, like longtime SF, street art, which I didn't really know a lot about at the time. Like they had this space next door and they were doing shows. And we ran into each other in the city and he had left that other company. He was like, hey man, if you ever want to mess around with this stuff, like I could always use help. So I started helping him as, you know, the typical unpaid gallery intern. And I was pretty stoked with how that went. Little by little, just by virtue of being, I guess, responsible and not like a complete burnout who was there for like free markers and, you know, graffitiing up the bathroom. I eventually was like his assistant director. Like I kind of gave myself that title because of all the help I did, but that was what I wanted to do. And I kind of was like, well, shit, like it was around the time I realized I didn't like law. And I was like, I think this is probably what I'm good at. Like I've been really connected in the community while I've been in college. Like I really got connected with the community with this, like maybe marketing, like I could be just as diligent and like a smart businessman and I could still be involved with the arts. Maybe this is it. Like I got to get a job in marketing because I got to learn what the heck is marketing. Like, yeah. I don't know. I remember the biggest joke was like, oh, what do you want to do then? Like, I want a job in marketing. Like, what do you want to do in marketing? And I was like, I don't know. Like,
was it working there that you, because, you know, one of the things which we'll talk, we'll get more detail later is that, I mean, you're pretty well connected in various sorts of art communities here in the Bay.
Definitely.
So was it through that job that you were kind of starting to like really get one. Connect all the dots to all the like subgroups and like
through skateboarding and music? There was definitely some like early exposure to some groups and some communities in the city, and then, you know, through school. But then with that gallery, that opened up a lot more, and I kind of started getting to know a few other things. I had a couple other friends that were taking art a little more seriously at the time, and they kind of put me under their wing and you know, showed me a couple things and showed me, like, told me about who was who and the history of San Francisco. So, yeah, it was a mix of that. But I'd say right around that time was when things started really taking off.
Sure.
And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about my project Illitant later, but that was a daydream while I was at the law job. I came up with the idea for that while I was there. So, you know, from the law job and floundering, I should say, in terms of trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do in marketing. I did get a marketing job.
Right.
Spoiler alert, it was in tech.
Which tech company?
Dude, is this company, and I would never talk poorly about them because they don't deserve it and they were great to me. It's this company called Bugsnag. It was run by these two British guys who were great. And they gave me a shot. My then neighbor was doing like community content writing for them. And like they needed an events guy, and I'd been doing events at the gallery. Clearly responsible enough working at a law firm, I could handle it, do contracts. So I went and did their events and like some branding, light branding design and like making swag and like setting up booth designs for them and like traveling around the country and doing like demos. And it was really funny. It was a software company, again, Bugsnag, and the nerdiest stuff ever. Not to say it's bad. It was cool, like learning about it, but it was the most tech job I feel like I could have gotten. Like a really small startup. Everyone was sweet. They were selling software to developers, people who write code.
Yeah.
And it's like real time, find your crashes. Like, you know, if you've ever been on Facebook and you get like 404 error.
Yeah.
Like this software, at the time you would have to wait to stumble across someone being like, hey, every time I try to look at Lewis's dog, my shit crashes, you know?
Yeah.
And this software basically is like, oh, at this time, this person was on the computer looking at Lewis's dog and it crashed 4 times. Like, you should fix that. Here's your code. Here's where it's broken. So it's really cool software. Nowadays, right. That's more standard.
Right.
Like to fixing code and website problems. But yeah, like at the time, they were one of the few businesses on the cutting edge of trying to do that. And it was cool. I was there for like about 8 months. And like I like to say that we mutually felt like it was not the perfect fit. They let me go with a couple wonderful things. A laptop, which helped me out with a lot of my creative projects. Sure. Which was cool. And, you know, mutually felt like it was time to grow apart. So, you know, I left there. It was cool. I got a nice little severance. And, you know, so be it. That's life. Throws you at the curve. And that's kind of, this is the part where things probably start picking up a little more.
Just like art-wise, you mean?
Yes. Like this is when a whole bunch of free time got thrown in my lap and me trying to find new work didn't lead to much of anything in the form of a traditional stable 9-to-5 till SF MoMA. Interesting. So that period was really, really pivotal.
Well, because then you have to hustle, right? And yeah. And then when you hustle, you tend to like take work when you can. You start meeting up random people to see if they know somebody.
Yep. And that's exactly what I did. I mean, I had relationships with a bunch of businesses in the city, run by friends, like people. And I was like, okay, well, now I can be someone's assistant for free. And just, I was driving Lyft, you know, nearly full time. And I was doing a bunch of work. Like, I did retail at Park Life, you know, Derek and Jamie, which was awesome.
How did you even get connected to Park Life?
Shopping.
Just walking in there and talking to them.
Talking to them, talking their heads off. You know, if I ever make a zine, will you carry it? That type of shit. Funny to think like where those conversations started to like now where, you know, we have a much better relationship. We're really close friends. I like to think in terms of peers in the art world and like we both support each other's projects and I think what they're doing is great. Like they've been here almost as long as I have, their store.
Yeah.
A record store. I mean, you're sitting next to like 1,000 or more records. Like I.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you even told me one time you went to like some record store like event that was in LA.
Yeah. And
I was
to sell like, records. Yeah. So my buddy Chris owns one of the coolest record stores in the Bay and in the city for sure. Groove Merchant Records. And Chris Veltri is the man, like just great dude, took me under his wing and showed me some stuff about records. And I worked with him. And when I wasn't working, I was like, hey man, like, you have shifts, like, or not even that, like, can I just make your website to put it on my resume? And like, can I help you like do cool shit at the shop? And he was like, yeah, let's do it. And then like, yeah, I don't know. Then I was just kind of like unabashed, like, do you need help? Like, right. That's basically how it started. Like my friend, one of these guitars he made by hand, he had a guitar making business. And I was like, do you need photos of your guitars? And yeah, like a person I assisted, a photographer I met at an event. I was like, hey man, like really love your work. Like, where do you live? I live here in the inner Richmond. I was like, me too. Oh, let's exchange emails. And then out of the blue, he's like, I'm older. I need someone to help me with installations. Can you help? And you know, and that artist, Michael Jang, the photographer in the city, is in our collection at work.
Sure.
And he was the person who pretty much stuck his neck out for me for the last two jobs I've had at the museum.
Wow.
So it all led to something. And at the time, I remember feeling like this is kind of bleak, like with work at least.
What do you think it is about you that, because it sounds like a lot of your successes, or at least the ability to keep surviving, right, is you just like making connections and all these like
I think friends. It's my family.
You think it's just like what, your
yeah,
family?
I mean, like maybe that's naturally why we spent so much time talking about that, because I realize I'm like, oh, I'm blabbling. I always tend to do that about my family, but it's such an important part of me.
Sure.
And as an adult, I've come more to recognize that.
Yeah.
Whereas before, it was just kind of like this peripheral thing that just was.
Yeah.
But yeah. Like my family has been really crucial in all of that. And they've been, you know, they own small businesses as interpreters. They had to get their own clientele.
Yeah.
My family had to sustain by competing against each other through my adolescence to support me, like my mom half, my dad half, and like all the way to college. And it's just like, they had to rely on their relationships with people to be successful. That's a very Latino quality, I'd say.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, I'm sure you can relate, but like that's how my parents hustled their business. That's how our family friends who are successful now started, you know, like giving out free samples. Like it's the whole idea of like goodwill and, you know, building relationships as a means to get something going.
You know, one of the biggest things, like pieces of advice that both my parents always used to tell me. And I remember they would tell me this when I graduated from high school, when they dropped me off at college, you know, like when I graduated from college. It was the idea that they used to tell me, one, number one, never be afraid to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And two, always ask advice from everybody. Doesn't mean you have to take it all, but like ask everybody what their perspective is on it. Because the more you learn, the more different perspectives you got, the more information you had.
Yeah.
Which allowed you to like then like make a better decision, right? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because that's the concept, right? Is that like you have to mingle with everybody because like you don't know, you know, like I don't, you know, my dad used to tell me like I didn't know anything about raising a kid, so I asked a friend who already had two kids, you know, and then he became friends with that guy that already had two kids, and then like next, you know, he like would learn stuff from that guy. And then he's like, I didn't know anything about, he's like, about football, but you wanted to play football. So I asked a guy who had already had two kids playing football.
Yeah.
And it was like, and then he became friends with that guy, you know, and that was like his network, he would tell me, right? And I feel like that's the same concept. And maybe he is a Latino thing. I don't know
what it is. I think it must be, man. Yeah. Like, I don't know. You got to think, like, so many Latino people are, I mean, there's plenty of bad businessmen, women, but, like, there's a stereotype of just, like, the hustle and, yeah. like, doing that well and, like, understanding people's psychology and people's things and their needs. Yeah. And, like, I was totally raised on this idea with, like, I want to learn from everyone. I remember early on, it was trippy. I was like, the most valuable thing I can learn from someone is seeing them mess up.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't take any kind of personal joy in seeing people make mistakes, but I genuinely respected and appreciated if I could learn from it. Right. Like if they were, you know, confident enough or like, you know, felt sure enough to like explain why that was a mistake. Again, giving advice. That's a lot of what advice is. Like, right. you know, do this way because of this experience I had. And like, you know, I have an anecdote to think about why I make these decisions this way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think yeah. like it was just very simple for me. I was like, I'm not asking people for money. Like, thankfully, like I have a job and I'm able to be a survivor because my parents taught me that. And, you know, every 2 months when I'm like, shit, I could use a couple $100. Like, luckily my parents are able and like understood and were able to help me for like the year and a half that I wasn't working. And that was great. And, you know, I think knowing that I didn't need money or things to survive, like I could provide that for myself. I was like, the things you're missing knowledge, you're missing all these things. And like right away, I just gravitated toward mentor figures. And maybe that's a separate symptom. Like I was always a middle child. So I was like, it was kind of weird. And like, I was also the bottom of a bunch of older families. So asking for advice was for sure the thing. And like not following advice was probably even more. But like, that's just how it is.
Right. So now we're at a point where like, now you're in it. Now yeah. you're like getting the art scene. You're yeah, like making connections.
I'm
unemployed.
I was like, I was daydreaming of making an art collective at the law firm. Great. I made it. I was daydreaming of having enough money to make my first zine. Like you work in tech, you're being paid really well, which was crazy. And like, you got a severance. Like,
well, tell me what drove you now that you wanted to start making things? Like you wanted to start making the zine.
I just like, a lot of people in San Francisco were making zines, man. Like, I don't know how else to explain it. Like, yeah. skating, there's like skate zines. Like, graffiti, there's graffiti zines. Like, there was definitely art zines. Like, definitely photo zines. Like, there, you know, knowing now what I know about photography, there's no reason why you don't see that correlation with photo book culture. Sure. Just like the dissemination of photography through books, which is so important to me, but also to like a lot of people in photography, like my boss included,
yeah.
at work, like Clement, you know, the senior curator of photography at the museum, he has that strong relationship with books and photography too. So just seeing those connections early on with just purely the things, there were music zines too. Like zines started because punk music couldn't get press. No one wanted to publicize punk music in tabloids or like Rolling Stone or magazines about music. They didn't want to talk about punk. So the only way they could get their info out was if they published their own magazine. And there were these little shitty stapled zines and they would pass them out and they would have like interview with this local punk band that no one talks about.
Yeah.
So like punk culture, which is inherently like, it was funny. Like one of the things I never really liked growing up as a skater was punk music, but now I've grown to love punk culture. Is so resourceful, DIY, you know, just like this doesn't exist. We're seizing it. We're making it ours. We are appropriating something that didn't exist and saying it's ours. Yeah. And we're all sharing it. And like, we're going to be actually really good to each other for the most part. Obviously there's right. punk scenes that are volatile and people in every scene, but you know, this open-mindedness and like, you know, you go to a punk show, if you're a punk, like everyone kind of shows you love. So it was like, I kind of felt that vibe here
too. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I was just like zines, like for sure. Like I can learn how to do that. I can get my photos, put them together and put them in a book. Like,
right.
Yeah.
It's like your way of being able to show your work without yeah. having to like find a gallery or impress somebody enough to like show their work.
I wasn't even thinking that. I was just like, yo, I love zines and I love collecting them. Like there's all these racks next to you on the top of these record shelves. There's boxes of zines.
Yeah.
And I have boxes more in storage that I could never get rid of. But like, I'm obviously, you can also tell I'm a collector.
Yeah.
Like I probably got that from my mom, but I don't know, just something hit with me. It was like, you know, those three legendary items in my life I mentioned earlier, the guitar, the soccer ball, the camera. I think like the zine quickly became that too. Like right. that idea, like this vessel for creativity.
Well, and funny enough, I mean, it's a cool vessel to like show all those three things you just said you love, right?
Yeah. And it was existing in all of them. Yeah. And like skateboarding is like the next closest thing that really fascinated me, the culture and like a sport and an ability, like visually what I thought and like aesthetically, I was like, this is great. Like this is all congruent. This all fits. Like I was just like, I gotta make a zine, man. And right away, you know, in true form, I was like, well, I'm not good enough to make one of just mine.
Yeah.
Like I know all these people that are kind of getting their art practice going. I think like maybe if I made like a group zine, I've seen those before. Like maybe if I pulled other people in with me, like this first attempt wouldn't be so, you know, putting myself out there. Like maybe it would get a little more love. Maybe by using community, we could make something that starts with a bigger bang. And right away I started enlisting my friends that I was like, you guys are doing really cool art right now. And you're starting out, like I've known you before your art practice. And now you're about a year or so into your art practice. Like, let's make something. I remember it took a year just to like convince everyone to like sit down, put things together, submit them, let me edit them and put them together, you know.
What made you want to be like the curator role in that though?
I wasn't even thinking about the curator. I was just the facilitator. I was like, if I don't do it, it won't get done.
Sure.
And I'm the only one that really wants to do it. And I want to put my stuff in a zine, but I don't want to do it alone. So I was kind of like, you know, a little timid about it.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, Austin, you make photos. You're going to do this. Like Brandon, my buddy that I met through some other people too. Like you like collages, like you're going to be in it. My buddy Drew, who I met through, I think the gallery back in the day, I was just like, or he was my neighbor. What am I saying? Drew, I was like, you're going to be in it too. Like you make lithograph prints. You're going to art school. Like he lived above me on 3rd and Geary. Muse, you're starting to paint. Like you've got some really cool stuff. Like you went to high school, obviously, with Brandon and Austin. That's how I know you guys. Like let's pull it in. So I had like a group of 6 to 8 people and we made the first volume of Illiton. And that, you know, part of my severance from that tech job funded that.
That's
like
crazy.
Initially I was like, I know it's going to take me like at least $600-$700 to print 100 zines of the quality that I want, like perfect bound, like kind of looking a little nicer, like more like a book. And I've got the severance. I'm just going to pull out that money, you know, withdraw it, put it in an envelope in my drawer. And like I did that. And then, you know, 8 months later we printed it.
Wow.
And that was it. And then, you know, after that we were like, what are we going to do? Let's circulate it, sharing it with people. And then this SF Art Book Fair comes along. I think right around the time I left that job. And right away I was like, I'm going to volunteer because I was going to go. But like now I don't have a job. I'm going to volunteer.
Yeah.
So I did. And like around the time I was working with Park Life, they were like, can you go drive this over? Can you go pick up the wine sponsor drop off for us? And, you know, after volunteering, I was like, this is so freaking cool. Like this community, this book fair culture. And I was like, I just made a zine. Like, what do I have to do to get into this? Like, I have to keep going.
Yeah.
And then from there, it was like, just snowballed.
Yeah, because now Illiton is like an actual collective. You've done how many volumes?
We're on our fourth volume.
Fourth volume, right?
We've been around for about, you know, 5-6 years now as an idea. We've been doing events for every zine. We're working with spaces. We have distribution in like other countries. We have stuff in shops.
Have you done shows?
Yeah, so that's part of the build out for each volume we do every year. And like after the first one, we were just really conflicted with what we were going to do after. And then just, I think it was Muse's idea. I have to credit him. Like he was just like, well, what if we just work with new artists every time instead of having to come up with new stuff every time? And I thought that was brilliant. And
well, allows you to grow the collective a little bit,
course.
Right?
And like we've always like made this, you know, I'm throwing up the, you know, the quotation marks, this involvement and membership is very loose. It's just kind of like you get to work with us by virtue of being in our community and us knowing your work and you being down to be in the zine. And the future of working with us is really up to you. It's up to you to come up with an idea that you want to do or propose a new artist for future collaboration. We've been lucky to keep going, but you know, it's not a true collective where we have this like fixed roster.
Sure.
Like some of the photo clubs that I might be a part of, or you know, one in particular, like it's not fixed. It's very loose and it's all based off the energy of people's projects.
Sure.
So if I can help you deliver your project, I'm all ready.
Yeah.
Here you go. And that's kind of been the impetus for the growth every year at the book fair too.
Yeah. And so then the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is, because another thing that you're a part of is the San Francisco Photography Club.
Yeah.
So tell me about that, because
I'd be happy.
Because I've tried to Google it. You guys don't have a site. It's basically an Instagram account.
Yeah,
right?
Basically an Instagram account. It's pretty fresh. It all kind of started. I mean, like, there's been a long history of photography collectives and groups in the history of photography that have formed by virtue of like friendship, proximity, community.
Group F60, the famous Group F64 is a San Francisco, basically a club.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, my understanding is through my buddy Austin, is really like, again, we got to know each other almost around the time that he agreed to be a part of Illiton and he moved up here. He's just a fantastic photographer. Like, honestly, you know, I have no shame because he's not here, but like, in terms of photographers doing work at his level and the fact that he was self-taught and like what his output is, I think he's one of the most exciting photographers in San Francisco. And he graciously has shared that with the community, and myself included. He taught me how to print in the darkroom, taught me how to process my own rolls. I still constantly seek advice from him. He's actually working as a docent, volunteer docent at Pier 24. That he's involved with Pier 24 pretty closely. And, you know, hopefully after he just finished a very delayed BA degree this June, hopefully there'll be some more stuff like that in the future on a more steady basis. But yeah, he's kind of like helped shape this momentum, I guess. And to go back to the club thing, he was always shooting street photography in the city, which is something I got into a little later than him, but it just seemed like really quickly as I learned more about photography and the art of it, what I was interested in was these candid, bizarro photos. I started really getting fascinated, again, with zine culture. Hamburger Eyes was such a pivotal part of shaping my interest in photo zines. Like that photo zine project. Are you familiar with it?
No.
Hamburger Eyes started in 2001. It's like a photo club as well of sorts, more just like a publication that was started by this guy, Ray Post. He's actually from San Diego.
Wow.
Like Encinitas zone, if I remember. Like, Wikipedia. Oh, wow. Yeah, like he's the homie.
Oh, man, I wish I could meet that
guy. I know. Yeah. He's down there now.
He's,
but
he's from my part of town.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. He's an SF legend. But my understanding of the story is he was working, I think, at a FedEx Kinko's and started getting really into zines. And he was always into photography, particularly black and white photography. And he was making tons of zines at the time. Eventually came up with this idea for this one zine, Hamburger Eyes. Just like a silly ass name, but it stuck, and it was a submission photo zine. And that's the one that really like took off. Like people were like, yo, this is cool. Like, and he was like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep making new issues of Hamburger Eyes. And from 2001 onward, it's just been an ongoing collective. Like I have a whole shelf of just like Hamburger Eyes copies that I like viciously hunt for the throwbacks. And like they had a photo lab in the alley in Lilac behind the McDonald's in the Mission. 24th Mission Bar for years, and it was the ultimate hangout spot. A few years ago, they had to get rid of it and like relocated to LA because of, you know, just all the issues with securing space in the Bay Area and San Francisco.
Right.
But that was like a legacy for like skating, graffiti, street photography. There are guys that went through street photography and Hamburger Eyes that are in our collection at work. There's plenty of well-known photographers that are working photographers, museum caliber and everything in between that are still putting photos there. It's an interesting legacy. The photographer, Michael Jang, who I worked with, I knew his work through Hamburger Eyes.
Wow.
And his work's in the MoMA. And he's just, there's a lot of San Francisco community with that a lot of people are very familiar with the project.
Yeah.
So anyway, I keep digressing. The club, like there was a lot of people that were shooting street at the time. Because of Hamburger Eyes in Austin, I started shooting more street. Austin had already met a bunch of guys because street photography is just as simple as like if you go every day, you start seeing the same people. Eventually you have a conversation. Eventually you have a beer. There was like a group of 10 guys that were like, you know, let's get more beers more often. You know, a couple of them were regulars in Hamburger Eyes.
Like there's that networking.
The more popularity. But they were in it. Like I wasn't allowed, but I wasn't like in it as much.
You were like on the peripheral because you knew somebody that was doing it.
Yeah, Austin was doing it. So like one day one of them was like, well, what if we just make a club? There are these guys in New York that made the New York City Street Photography Club. There's some people in other cities that do this. Like we should just have a club and put our efforts together to do something cool. Like I think part of it was like Hamburger Eyes is gone. Like what if we like did something? And Troy Holden and Dave Root were like some of the early guys that were involved in that, and Troy is like has a pretty great career. Dave does too, and like plenty of the other guys like do really cool stuff. Like Mark Merman is in former Hamburger Eyes heads. Like, it was all kind of like the older, younger end of street photography and guys that were really getting after it and seeing each other. And Austin was right there. So when they started it, he was part of it. And to make a long story short, like, I started tagging along pretty early on, but, you know, I wasn't part of the original crew. So I had to wait until they developed like a voting structure similar to like most collectives like that.
Sure.
And yeah, I got voted in like a little over a year ago, and I've been working with them, and fun. We meet once a month. We do a critique that's open to the public. Like, if you know someone in the club who wants to come, you know, you get in contact. It's this last Tuesday of every month. We meet in the basement of Glass Key Photo.
Nice.
You know, shout out Glass Key, one of the few.
The one in the Hate?
Yeah, they used to be in Lower Hate. Now they're on Sutter and Polk. But they're
they moved again.
Yeah, they're on the only analog photo store pretty much in the city. And they have a really cool basement. We like have a projector, we show work, we critique, we have guests. Once or twice a year we do a show and a zine, and that's, you know, it's been. And we just voted in some new cool members recently, and yeah, it's just kind of been like a fun way to organize what everyone's doing similarly. And
and is it, you know, the photos that you guys post, is it mostly on, like, is exhibited on Instagram? Because I look at
the Instagram, like, is like probably the main tool. Like, I think like a lot of visual art right now, I think Instagram is very pivotal to like the proliferation of that scene.
Sure. And yeah, because you even have on the Instagram account, like, who's running, like, who's curating it,
yeah,
right?
I recently had to myself, like last month, and I did probably a shit job at it, but probably because I was just...
And is it just getting photos from like the members?
Yeah,
of the club?
And making sure that you're not like recycling stuff by accident, and, you know, just a bunch of classic Instagram curatorial things that, you know, it's funny, reminiscent of my time in marketing at the museum. So it's just really funny.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, Instagram is one of the social medias that, I mean, really hits... I mean, it's photography in itself.
Yeah, you're sharing images.
Right. It's not like you're using Instagram to market your paintings. Like, you're actually using the actual advanced technology of photography to exhibit photography in a different form than just having it in a gallery on a wall.
Exactly. It's a trippy time, man. And I'm all the more for it in terms of utilizing, utilizing a tool in this instance to like enhance it. So it totally helps, and it's great. And I think we meet every month and we talk about the website coming. We talk about other things. So it's still in relative infancy.
Sure.
We're in year three, give or take, maybe a little on the young three. But yeah, SFCPC is pretty fun, and I've been enjoying being a part of it. We're going to have some of our new zine up at the table.
Sure.
We had a show recently during Street Photo in SF. Yeah. So we're getting some love, and it's fun.
Well, speaking of the table at the SF Art Book Fair, coming up this weekend.
It is. Shout out Culpa Press, Park Life, and Minnesota Street. 4 years running.
4 years. And it's great. It's always a hit.
Yeah, it's always a hit. And it started with, you know, similar thing, drive and a crazy idea, and, you know, wanting to have something in this community like they do in LA and New York. And it's great. I mean, like, it's all over at work. I do a good job of putting shit around, but I mean, like, everyone knows about it.
Flies are everywhere.
Coming. Yeah, they are. You know, and
there's
I like
no
to
reason
them.
For anybody who works this
to not
to
know
about this. So, well, let me ask you now, because this is the last thing I want to touch on is, like, so you, what is to look forward to on your end at SFR Book Fair? Like, I'm assuming you're doing stuff both for Illiton and the photo club.
Yeah, and everything in between, actually. So, going back to like how Illiton Volume 1 started, this idea of, you know, collective effort and output is greater than a singular effort. We were like, all right, we're going to do a table at the book fair. Let's try to apply. Oh shit, we got a table at the book fair. How many books do we have between us? Like, Austin's like, I'll make my first one. I've been waiting. And I was like, me too. I've got my first one. Like, all right, make Illiton 2. All right. So then we're kind of like scrambling, and we're like, well, what if we do what we've always done and like open it up to the community? Like, it seems like organization is such a tough spot for people, and like not everyone gets organized and puts together an application. A lot of people missed out. There's a lot of people that just have one zine between the group of them.
Right.
Like, what if we pulled their one zine and put it on our table? Like, what if we made it about being a local collective table showing different stuff? Why don't I invite Groove Merchant Records and see if they want to put some stuff out? And then all of a sudden, it's just like, that's become what we've done every year. And it makes it so fun.
So, like, is it like an Illiton table?
It's an Illiton table. And then we curate projects and you know, zines and books and other things from other people. We have a fair share of vintage ephemera, mostly in the form of paper goods, like bill, handbills, flyers, posters that we put on the wall to like attract attention, but they're all for sale, and then vintage books. That's through Groove Merchant. Chris, the owner of Groove Merchant, former photo lab tech and photographer in his own right. He collects tons of found photos. So we usually do a found photo project every year as a zine.
That's cool.
And this year we're doing a sequel to our first project, Record People, which is photos of people with their records.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're all found photos. Back then that used to be a thing.
I'm sure you remember your family. Yeah.
You got your new, you know, Vicente Fernandez album, you're going to post with it. You know? Your mom got the Julio Iglesias classic. Like, she's going to put a photo of her in her room with it and little hearts in her eyes.
Oh, but, well, makes me miss my weekends growing up.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe for some of like people a little older than us, there was like a, you know, that finally they got that Beatles record, that Michael Jackson record. But anyway, these photos have existed. He's been collecting them. And we did a first volume that was super successful and rad. This next one is part two, finally, like 3 years later. So we do things with Groove Merchant. Then the other parts of the table that are part of the foundational group, the organization, are Austin and Muse, who help curate the new Illitant projects. Mm-hmm. They usually put something out themselves. Last year we had like painted book sculpture objects by Muse. This year we actually have a formal catalog for his painting show.
Nice.
So that's really exciting to work with him in a more in-depth way about his painting practice. Sure. And work with his space, part two, who you're familiar with, Brock,
right,
as well. So that's been really special this year as an addition. Austin and I always have something in the works. He's got a cool new photo zine and I have one. Told you already, Illitant Volume 4 is coming out with a whole new roster, which is really fun. Shout out fellow museum head and local Richmond person, Gina Contreras, who's going to be, you know, having some paintings in it. I'm really excited about it. So, and then, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the spread of the five options that we put on the table. And as usual, we've reached out to the community and we got a bunch of other things going from plenty of people from around the Bay Area and Oakland and people from the South Bay. Sure. Occasionally some other, you know, more distant friends from other coasts and from other parts of California throw down. But we always have a pretty strong local representation. And I think that's what makes us an attractive exhibitor for the book fair. And it's certainly what I love about this book fair. It's not as big, unfortunately. A lot of people get left out by virtue of that, which sucks. And I'm sure that they do they have a horrible time having to pick which new people get accepted, which people get rejected. And I hear all the stories, but it's the fact that they put an emphasis on the local scene to me is really special.
Sure.
When you go to a book fair in a city, you want to see what the city's making.
Sure. Like, and the cool part about your table is that you are helping like
a lot of other
people. A lot of people, like people that the fair organizers feel bad about rejecting because we ran out of space.
Or they might not even apply.
Right.
They might be people who are even doing amazing things in their own right, like museum level or otherwise art practices that want to put something out. And, you know, we've had things from like my younger brother's first zines to like a museum level photographer in our collection putting a book out. So
it's like you're giving these people giving them a flag to fly under, basically.
Exactly.
Because a lot of people they're not associated with Copa Press or they're not associated with Park Life.
Yeah.
So they don't have like a table to go at, but you kind of like, well, you need one. We got space for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And like I let it be really organic. Like I don't seek out too many people and like a lot of people come to us now, which is really special. And it ends up being a pretty, it comes across all organically. Sometimes a little too last minute than they like, even though I'm a total last minute guy. You know, I'm a good stoner in that way. But it's, it's pretty funny. I think that it does truly come together by virtue of like how the project is set up. So that's something that I always like. And I think people really enjoy it when they see it in person. You don't get like a carbon copy of the year before, but you certainly like have a familiar feeling to it. Like,
yeah.
It does feel some ways. So
yeah,
we have a good time with it. It's gonna be a fun weekend, man. I look forward to it every year. I'll be burnt out after it. But I wouldn't want to do it any other way.
Sure.
I've learned to love that deadline out of the deadlines that get me to do stuff in life, you know. As an adult you love deadlines, I guess. But
so I want to end on this one, which please. I always ask. Long term, what do you see yourself doing? I mean, like, and I feel like I've had this conversation with you all the time because you're so involved in so many different things.
Yeah.
But I feel like even after talking to you right now is the common thread I'm getting is that you're a really good organizer just because by your inherent natural ability to be able to like connect with people and connect people with other people, yeah. right? And put the bring them all together. So like long term, what do you kind of see yourself doing? Like still doing this long term, or do you see yourself doing it like at a larger scale? Like, you know, having your own gallery or having your own publishing, like press, like kind of like Copa Press to do this stuff.
Certainly. I mean, I think that's, you're thinking of something that swirls around in my brain and like almost is too scary to like really stick a pin in, so to speak, because I've kind of let it happen and it's been reciprocal in a way that it's been rewarding and also given me so much. So I'm taking it one year at a time. Sure. I don't really know yet. I think like in the fall, I'm going to finish this first year in the photo department at the museum, which I've been so rewarding and so great in so many ways. But I'm going to do some thinking to just see like, what does the future look like?
Sure.
Will I be publishing still? Absolutely. Will I ever get the opportunity to manage my own space or own it? Like, I think that would be killer.
Yeah.
Like, regardless of what I'm doing for a living.
Yeah.
I think that those things are absolutely going to keep happening. As long as my knees work, I'll be kicking a soccer ball for fun every week. As long as I can be dedicated, I'll be involved with music and like hopefully making my own music, which has always been something the one thing I have left to like really go into.
Sure.
To try to like produce something in terms of like the way my first zine, like my first song or first album that I record consciously, with the idea of it being as good as it can be. So yeah, to answer your question, I will be doing these things for sure. Whether there's a moment where it clicks and it suddenly enters that realm of that being like my overall life and my source of, for lack of something more, you know, poetic, my source of income, I guess I'd say like my livelihood.
Right.
That's maybe that sounds a little better. Let's say that. So my livelihood, whether that's more tied and correlated to my livelihood, not really sure yet. But I think the more I keep, it seems clear that the more I keep pursuing these opportunities and kind of going for it, that those, you know, very possible realities of me doing this for a living and doing this in a bigger capacity are way more obvious than when I was younger, when I wasn't even like even interested in thinking about it. Like now it just kind of feels like it's going that way. So, you know, I'm not sure. I like to think I'm pretty open. I've always been pretty pragmatic, so I'll stay on my feet as much as I can. And I have a great support system. I have an amazing partner. My girlfriend's great. My family's just as great as always. My friends and community are great. So, you know, for now, I'm enjoying it. And I think that in the future, if those opportunities present themselves to me, I will absolutely not turn them away. And yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on, man. And yeah.
I'm happy. I hope my story was cool. I really, you know, in the cheesiest way possible, because it should be. I hope that people are stoked to hear this. If it's not entertaining, then I'm sorry or not. I don't care. But if you can take one thing out of it, you should definitely go out and do your own thing. It's special, and you know, it might not start the way you want it, and doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
Yeah. I don't know. Cool. All right, man. Thanks.
No problem.
All right, everyone, that's it for today. Thanks again for listening, and thanks again to Adrian for coming on. The San Francisco Art Book Fair opens Friday, July 19th at 6 p.m. over at the Minnesota Street Project, and then runs through Sunday, July 21st. For more information on this weekend's programming, visit sfartbookfair.com. You can also follow them on Instagram at sfartbookfair. Be sure to stop by and say hi to Adrian over at the Illitante table and check out what they're exhibiting. You can also follow Illitante on Instagram at Illitante and the San Francisco Photography Club at SFCPC. All right, till next time, everyone.